This is the First Time Podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. Jessie Stevens is a Sydney-based writer and podcaster. She's an executive editor at Mamma Mia, Australia's largest independent women's media company. She co-hosts Mamma Mia's flagship podcast and winner of Australia's best podcast series, Mamma Mia Out Loud. Her debut book, Heartsick, based on three true stories, was an international bestseller. And her first novel, Something Bad Is Going to Happen, came out in September this year. Welcome, Jessie, to the First Time Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, we are going to talk about books and publishing and a whole host of other stuff related to that. But first, one of the things that we love hearing about on this show is where people's writing life began, their kind of author origin story. So in that vein, writing's obviously a big part of your life now. Was it the same when you were growing up?
Oh, as soon as you asked that, I just had this flash of me at five, and there's a photo of me sitting there with like a pen and paper and a cat. Our cat kept trying to sit there and like stop me from writing, and I was like, no, I want to keep writing. And I'd write these stories that are so problematic looking back. I was obsessed with, because obviously I'm a twin, but I didn't want to write about that. So I kept writing about like conjoined twins, which all the wrong language, just definitely not right. But I think it was my imagination, you know, trying to think outside the box. And then when I went and saw the movie Titanic when I would have been 9 or 10, I got home and I sat down with a pen and paper and just wrote out the story. And it was about 20 pages long. And I knew I felt inspired, but I don't think I knew what to do with that inspiration. So I just wrote down what I saw. And then really sadly, I think at about 13 or 14, I stopped with the creative stuff because the editing perfectionist brain really kind of spiked, and it became about marks and results. And it wasn't until, you know, 30 that I went, well, I guess with Heartsick, my first book, there was an element of creativity in that. But in some ways that was warming me up to really be able to sit down and go, I'm going to write a fiction story, which is what I want to do, but I feel as though I don't have the skills. But I knew the only way to get the skills was to actually try and do it.
That's so interesting. I want to come back to that idea of goals and that period in your life that sort of focused on that. From a writing perspective, you've obviously written for Mamma Mia for a long time. Do you remember the first thing that you ever had published?
Yes, I do. My twin sister and I were writing recaps of The Biggest Loser, like tongue-in-cheek critical analysis going, how is this show on television, essentially? But sending it up a bit. They were comedy recaps. And they were stumbled upon by Mia Friedman at Mamma Mia. And then we wrote just sort of silly cultural pieces. We wrote something about a woman's right to activewear, I think was one of the first, because people kept saying that leggings weren't pants. And I was like,
that was a real thing. There was a period of time where that was a hot kind of hotly debated topic. Yeah.
And I feel as though leggings won out. And I'm proud to say perhaps I had a part in that. So I remember writing that. And I was like, oh, having your writing published on the internet, like I look back and I'm horrified. If I had the energy, I would go and delete everything I wrote in those first few years because you're just so embarrassed. But that's also you finding your voice. And I think you can really spot that, me trying to find my voice over the years. And that really developed through working with incredible editors and trying to learn the craft.
That's so interesting. Was there In terms of moving from that article-based work to the writing of books, was there a particular moment that stands out as the beginning of that part of your career?
Yes. So I had a few people in the industry say, I'd written sort of opinion articles that had gone, you know, a little bit viral, and they'd come across people and they'd, you know, certain people. I remember meeting Peter Fitzsimons, and he'd read something I'd written and he said, "You need to write a book. You need to write a book because people will take you seriously when you write a book." And I thought, that's an interesting reason. And then I kind of parked that, and I did a book club series because I've always been just a big, big reader. I did a book club series where I interviewed Jane Harper, Trent Dalton, like Paulina Simons, all these incredible writers. And I realized that I was asking them, it probably wasn't interesting to anyone else because it was just me basically asking how to become an author and like how they did it. And I realized that's why I was doing it. And their
generosity, I can sympathize.
Their generosity was like a masterclass in how to write a book. And then because I'd never studied creative writing, because I didn't, and I was right, I didn't have any skills in it. I did a course, like a short writing course, which was like a 6-week thing, where it was called Unlocking Creativity, I think. And it was an online thing. Fabulous. It was really, really good. And I think that was a real catalyst in going, maybe I can do this.
Well, you certainly did do it. Heartsick, your first book came out in 2021. It was a bestseller. So it's difficult enough to get a book published in this country. To sell a lot of books, both here and internationally, a lot harder. When did you realise the book was going to do well?
So I'd written it and I hated it. I hated it more. I was embarrassed by it. Like, I was embarrassed at what I had attempted to do, which was quite audacious. Like, I think that trying to write those three stories of heartbreak, and it was an ambitious book. And I thought, you tried to do this thing, you got to the end, I don't have the feeling I expected to have. I think that if I had 10 more years, I could make this so much better, but I don't. And I submitted it, and nothing anyone, you know, my editor was lovely, but they're not there to, you know, stroke your ego. They're there to make the book better and better. And so nothing anyone said made any difference. And I was like, I'm embarrassed. I hate it. And then early.
So it had sold at this point and you were still like.
Yes, but it was sold on an idea. So it was sold on, I'd written a little bit and then they'd bought it and then I'd written it. And I thought, well, what are they going to do? Right. And I also had this thing in my head, which is, you're a podcaster with a little bit of a following. So they probably think regardless, they're going to sell a few copies. What if this book is terrible and no one's telling me? Like, that was honestly what was going through my head. And then they did endorsements and I thought, well, of course they said nice things. What choice did they have? Like, still, I didn't believe it. And it was only when Jane Harper shared a thing on her Instagram about it and her US agent saw it, asked for a copy, read it in 24 hours, and then reached out and said, I want to represent her in the US, that I went, what would be his incentive to say?
Yes.
Like, it was a moment where I went, oh, wow, maybe I've pulled something off here. And that was the first moment I allowed myself to think, maybe this isn't the worst thing ever written.
Good moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
Signs before that, but that's a good peak moment. Well, your first novel, so second book, first novel, Something Bad Is Going to Happen, only recently been released. The starting point for this one is that we meet Adele. She's in her late 20s. When we meet her, she's in a psychiatric unit recovering from a mental breakdown. Mental health, very central to this book. You've written and you've spoken about your own struggles with mental health. What of your own experience did you want to capture in this story?
I have a quote at the beginning from Virginia Woolf that's something along the lines of truth here contains, I've got it here. Yes, here, I'll quote it. A Virginia Woolf quote that says, fiction here is likely to contain more truth than fact. And so I knew the feeling. I went in with a feeling, which is something about the essence of my 20s. There was no particular moments I was hoping to capture, but the truths were, firstly, I knew there would be a relationship between a man in, and a woman in their 20s that was not romantic, but was based on sort of an understanding that they both had their own struggles and how differently they dealt with them. Mm. So I knew I would do that. And in that way, that's drawn from my best friends. I have two really, really close friends, both of whom are male. And you don't see that a lot. Mm. You often see, you know, female friendships, and there's not a romantic element there. So that mattered to me. To have a generational storyline in my family, it's my grandfather, my father, and then myself who have, and my siblings who have struggled significantly with depression. And in this, I knew I wanted to show that through line. And I suppose the other thing that came through that I knew I could write authentically was an experience of writer's block, or feeling like there's one thing that defines you, one thing you've been good at since you were five, and having that stolen, and then having to think, hang on, who am I without this? So I suppose that perfectionism, achievement stuff, I knew I wanted to play with, and they were all drawn from my life.
Mm. It's her world so quickly unravels. I said this before we started talking, but it would be easy to think that a book that features depression so heavily could be depressing itself to read, but it's absolutely not. It feels very hopeful. How important is it to you to have light in a story, and where do you find it?
That was part of my pitch, is I remember writing, I've been really interested in this genre for a really long time. That's where I turned when I was in my early 20s, and I read Man's Search for Meaning and Darkness Visible and The Bell Jar, and Virginia Woolf, and trying to make sense of it. And so having read those, there were lines of hope, but I thought The Bell Jar in particular is devoid of a lot of hope, I think, because of what happens when you read the ending. You kind of go, oh my God, all right, does anyone ever get better? And I think that we've also had this narrative that when you are diagnosed with anxiety or depression, it's sort of a life sentence. Mm. And in a way, there's a truth in that. But I'm also surrounded by people who have gotten better. And I thought, how might we tell that story, and how might I model it? Could this be actually helpful? There's a quote that I hold very dearly that says that on the worst days something funny happens, and on the best days something bad happens. Mm. And I think that's very true. To write a one-note book is not indicative of reality. So I thought, it was funny, some chapters I wrote that were really, really dark, and I actually went back and I had on my to-do list, inject light.
Yeah, fine.
That was actually part of my editing process, because I went, this is too bleak. That might have been how you were feeling when you wrote it, but where's the life in it? And so I actually did that very intentionally.
I love that. Adele is in, although she has platonic relationships with men, she also has a particular relationship with a guy. It's not like the best relationship. I'm interested in this idea of, like, on the one hand, you can interpret this relationship as, here is an individual making poor choices. But on the other, there's a real familiarity to this story. Yeah. There are elements of the experience that do resonate and will with many women. Of those two things, individual making poor choices, something more gendered, does one resonate more with you?
That's such a good question. Look, both are at play. Certainly both are at play. But I think the gendered explanation speaks to me really deeply, because there's something going on with how dehumanizing dating can be for young women. And the fact that people read that Well, in some people read it and went, why is she being such an idiot? And I was like, oh, I'm so jealous you've never had that experience.
Yes.
And so many more women read it and they were like, oh, that's relatable. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a perfect storm of and it's not just this generation, but having women with self-esteem in the toilet. Like they just don't have any, they don't have enough self-worth to resist this kind of character. But there's definitely a gender play at work, which is like, there's such cruelty to it. There's a desperation that feels as though it's like you're reeking of this desperation. And then there's a line in it about heterosexual couples or men and women for at least a period. And it's like, you don't like each other. Like women don't actually like, I think that there's a contempt that a lot of men hold for female interests, female pastimes, how they talk, what they want to talk about. And you know when you're spending time with someone whether they're interested in who you are. And I think I dated a lot of people who weren't. And when you have that experience over and over again, I don't understand where the self-esteem is meant to be built. Mm. And yes, maybe you are choosing that because it's comfortable, but it's like we all need a circuit breaker, like someone to come in and be like, don't cop that. Mm. Because it just, your self-esteem gets more and more destroyed. And then you sort of try and jump back on the horse. And then the first person who shows you any interest, you go with them again. So there is something deeply gendered happening, I think. And I think that's helpful in then women maybe reappraising their individual choices and going, you're not imagining this, but what can you do to change your future?
There's also this lovely moment within the platonic relationship where Adele sort of makes the point that you're one of the good to her friend, like you're one of the good guys, but you're also like one of the shit ones, you know, yeah. Depending on what kind of a relationship you have with an individual is which yeah. experience you get.
That's based actually on a real experience we had with a bunch of friends once. And I remember one of the loveliest guys I know, he was talking about dating and he didn't say anything that was, you know, ridiculously sexist, but he said something that was dismissive of who he was dating. And one of the women that was there just broke down in tears and was like, not you two, like not, this is how I know I'm being talked about. And what hope do we have if it's you as well? And maybe there's a disposability to the way a lot of men are treating relationships in their 20s. Whereas for me, I wanted that stability so badly and the men I was dating didn't. And therefore the terms were not equal.
Mm, it's very true. As writers, you've written two books now. You've also got a wealth of writing that you've done for Mamma Mia, but we tend to circle the same topics, coming at them in completely different ways. What are the themes that you gravitate towards in your work?
The big one that I've found a lot of meaning in recently is class. That's one that I find myself coming back to and back to. I remember during COVID, there were a lot of ways you could look at things. There was a vaccination debate and there were all of that. And I felt like class was a massive one we weren't considering. I remember looking at the treatment of Western Sydney as opposed to the eastern suburbs and looking at what lockdown meant when you were in an apartment building with no green spaces within your radius and when you're in lockdown and you live on Bondi Beach. And it was like Australia wasn't talking about the inequality of that. So I remember being really pulled to class. And I think in this moment about identity politics, it's been really overlooked that the differences in our experiences. So class is a big one for me. And definitely feminism, and that's evolving always evolving with what I read. And the other one, it doesn't come up in the book so much, but I have a number of relatives with intellectual disabilities. And so disability has been a big one that I feel compelled when it's something that comes up in the news or there's something I feel that needs to be said from the perspective of someone who knows that subject intimately, like I really care about that. And I suppose mental health is as well, and providing a bit more nuance to the conversation that isn't just "Are you okay day?"
Are you okay day? Yeah, no comment. Okay. So the act of writing in some ways is more straightforward than or is in some ways the more straightforward part of being a writer, but the other is the head game. Your sister Claire interviewed you recently on the "But Are You Happy" podcast, and one of the things that you spoke to, and I'm paraphrasing, but you kind of mentioned it a little bit here, is this thing around ambition, but really the tension between ambition and contentment. Is this a tension for you? Has it always been a tension, and how do you manage it?
Yes, and I think that it exists, like it is so present for people who want to be writers because, and I think that writers want to be writers. Like I don't think there's any point at which you go, "I'm a writer." Like you feel as though you're always trying to do a thing. And even when you've done the thing, it's like I've always, you think you're going to arrive at this point and look around and go, "I've done this, I've done it. And here's the joy and satisfaction and pride that I've been looking for since I was five." I've never found it. I've never found it for 30 seconds. Like there's excitement, there's relief, but I wouldn't say there's a, I don't know if it's just not part of the human condition, but that's been a hard lesson to learn and then a liberating lesson to learn because you go, if you think winning awards and, you know, getting the book deal and selling this many books is going to bring you happiness, then you're absolutely wrong. So you need to find where the joy is, and the joy is in the doing. When often that's actually really, really hard. But you've got to know why you're doing it, because if it's for that, you will be disappointed. And I think writers don't know how not to write. It's just this impulse that like you have to do it so that you feel most yourself. You don't feel like you without doing it. And that's enough for me now, I think. And I had a much healthier relationship going into the publication of this book, I think, because it's not about proving anything to anyone or thinking that I'm finally going to feel complete. I think my relationship with achievement has been very toxic in that way.
I read a quote recently that was something like, "The fun is in the climb," which I think really resonates. But at the same time, the climb would be funner if you realized you got to the top. Like, like that would kind of be the perfect sort of.
That's the thing is that.
What is wrong with me?
There is nothing, even writing the second one, it's like I have no assurance I'm going to finish this. I have no certainty that it's going to make sense or be good. And that's what makes the climb so terrifying. But that's, I suppose, where the satisfaction comes are those, you do have moments where you go, "Oh, that sentence is it," or, "Oh, I solved that problem." Because I think writing is just 1,000 problems that you've got to solve. Every sentence is a problem. Every scene is a problem. It's just solving, solving, solving. But then when you're finished, you still don't feel like you solved it because you're like, it could be better. I think all writers probably feel that.
In that same "But Are You Happy" podcast, which is an excellent podcast, you talked a little bit about the idea that you might show the highs, but you might not show the lows. So an example that you gave was the first book was a subject of an auction in the US. That makes the Instagram feed. When the second's not picked up by the US publisher, doesn't make the feed. Obviously, we all do this.
Yeah.
do you have rules around what, like vulnerability or what you'll share of disappointments?
It's really hard. I'm terrible at vulnerability is what I've learned. And I'll be honest about things when I'm asked about them, but I don't like the idea that strangers get access to my pain. That I think I'm not totally comfortable with. So if I'm still processing some sort of rejection or failure, the other thing is that the reason I don't want to share that is because it's like, I don't want you to think that I feel entitled for that book to be sold, because I don't. I don't feel hard done by. I don't feel cheated. I just feel disappointed, I suppose. So I think it's just a reminder, though, that every writer is using their Instagram profile to sell books. So the rule is, what's going to sell my book? Like, yeah. And that's why, you know, I'm not going to share the terrible Goodreads reviews or someone who messaged me who didn't like it, because that's not going to move it. And that's also, you know, not who the book was for. And it's not good for me to stew on that. I see people share what their trolls say and the awful DMs, and I understand in some cases why they do it, but life is short. We've only got so many things to focus on. Like, I tried really hard at this book, and I'm going to look at the good stuff to try and, you know, not have enough guts to sit down and write something else one day.
To continue, however, to delve into disappointment.
Yes.
What do you tell yourself when you're disappointed with how something goes?
You know, I think every author, every creative that I admire doesn't have a one-note career. When there's disappointment, I go, there it is, because it's got to be amongst it. In fact, I get really suspicious when there's too many good things, because I go, oh, this isn't how it goes. Like, everyone talks about the second book slump or whatever it's called. Like,
syndrome.
Most people's second book bombs. Because maybe their first book took them 10 years and then they felt they had to write the second quickly or whatever. It's weird. And so I guess I was quite prepared for that. But there's no career of anyone I admire that isn't full of disappointments. And that's part, I think disappointments make me feel like an artist. It's like, oh, yes.
Well, that is a great reframing.
This is my artist moment where, like, I just haven't been understood or something, you know, ridiculous.
But there is something, I think, in that that kind of, it's almost like your own voiceover, where you see it in the context of something much bigger, and that it's not the end, it's just a part of the overall arc.
Yeah, and even with, like, I can do my best with my work, but there are authors who I adore who have written 10 books, and not all 10 are my favourite. Mm. If you're going to keep writing and keep creating, not everything is going to suit everyone. That's the nature of it. So you can write one book if you want, and then that can be your one book. But if you're going to keep trying, then the failure is absolutely inevitable.
Mm. Still continuing this theme of ambition but also goal setting, some people use vision boards to articulate what they want, these affirmations, manifesting. How consciously do you think about what you want or want to achieve in life?
I have for years sat down, usually in January. I said to a friend recently, I only have patience for Oprah for the first 9 days of January. Every year I get really into Oprah, and then it gets to like the 10th of January and I'm like, I've had enough. So I become very like manifesting in that first week. And I have lists in notebooks that are like, this is what I want to do this year. This is my focus. This is why I'm doing it. And I will look back a year to find things, and I don't refer to it. I don't go back and look at it every day or mantras or anything like that. I just write it down. It is incredible what's happened.
Yeah, like, right.
Where something will happen. Something happened recently. I think it was Q&A when I was doing Q&A for publicity for this book, and I told my sister, and she was like, 5 years ago you said you wanted to do that. And I was like, did I? And I found a list, and it's like Q&A. And it just, the specificity of things that I guess you unconsciously are making a series of choices that might lead you there. So That's been really good. But I must say that this year I was pregnant in December, January, like up until July. And I had to reframe it a bit. And that was also really liberating because I went family. And I didn't feel guilty about that. And I didn't feel like a failure. And I think that's something I'm learning too, is that it can't all just be a checklist of like external facing, exciting things you can put on a LinkedIn profile. Like that's been some of the most satisfying stuff is the private moments I've had in the last, you know, 3-4 months.
Do you, I'm obsessed with this stuff. Do you like really specifically, like if you say Q&A, like you are that, you are specific, and do you have a number that you put of things you put on a list, or you just like till you run out of?
Till I run out of things that are, that are true. So even with a book, like I'll sit down and I'll go, okay, you want to write this book. Why? Like what does success look like to you for this book? And it's like, be honest, like if it's winning the Stella Prize, then just write that. Like not that you have any control over that, but that will frame the book you write. So I think, you know, what does, do you want it to be a bestseller? Because that's a different thing to having a book that that maybe deeply resonates with a particular demographic or whatever. So I'm very specific about what I want that to be before I start. And even, the mood of a book and all that kind of stuff, I'm very, determined about it.
We're going to talk podcasting, sort of. You are the co-host of one of the most popular podcasts in Australia, Mamma Mia Out Loud. Your co-hosts are writers and authors. Your sister's a writer. Presumably, this is not about podcasting, I'm realizing. You have friends that are writers. Writing community is the best. But having a lot of friends that are writers can invite comparison too. Like, I think you can be really proud and pleased for another fellow friend and author, genuinely, and also want what they have. Not to take it off them, but just to want it kind of as well. So I want to talk about the idea of jealousy really in two ways. One, jealousy that you might experience, but also jealousy that you could be the subject of.
Yes. I think jealousy, I've always used it as a bit of a guiding light. So if I'm looking at someone and going, oh, someone did something recently and I went, I saw something on Instagram and I had to close it and I went, I'm so jealous. I'm pissed off. I'm jealous. And I was like, why? And I went, because I want that. And then I went, okay, that's so clarifying. I will write that down that I want that. And that's not that person's fault. In fact, thank you for allowing me to see that that's the thing I want. Because often as well, you don't know what you want until you see someone modeling it. So my twin sister is writing a book at the moment and I keep looking at her and going, I wish I'd had that idea. Like her idea for this book is so, you know, those books that Sally Hepworth had, like always has a book like this, where it's two sentences and you go, okay, everyone who reads will read that bloody book. I'm not good at that. I have a really and I'm terrible at like elevator pitches and really, really bad. My sister's book is like, that will sell everywhere because of one sentence. And then I go, okay, well, that's an inspiring idea, I suppose. Like that's the benchmark of a brilliant idea. The harder thing, I suppose, and I don't know if it's always jealousy, but there's a guilt that comes with success or, you know, some sort of maybe you've been nominated for something and someone else hasn't and you know how hard they worked. And I think there's an awkwardness because as your friend, you want to go, this thing's happened, but then I won't tell them because I feel like it's rubbing it in their faces, but then they feel kind of, I don't know, left out a little bit. So I think that's really hard, but how we've navigated it is being super honest about it and going, I'm really jealous about that. That's and having a bit of a laugh because it's very clear, I think. And also going, I'm jealous because I'm disappointed because my book didn't do that. And then, yeah, that's been great. Like even speaking to Sally Hepworth, for example, her books in the US, like she is a New York Times bestselling author. Oh. And I was speaking to her recently. And, you know, I'm speaking to Sally and I'm going, I'd do anything for this book to sell in the US. And then the nature of authors, though, is that, you know, Sally will go, you know what, I'm going to email someone or whatever. Like that's the camaraderie that happens very true. Those communities, because they know how hard it is. And it was so funny. Sally just said in an instant, she was like, oh, some book club picked my book up and that's the only reason it's a bestseller. Like there's very little ego in the writing community, I think. A lot of, like, everyone just thinks it's all just a fluke of luck. So, yeah, she's not sitting there going, oh, well, my book's better than yours. So I think the honesty's helped.
I will now ask about podcasting. Podcasting as a medium is super intimate. I think it's intimate because it's intimate when you're creating it. It feels like just a conversation, but it's also intimate in the listening because sometimes it feels like you're listening to a conversation that you're a part of whilst not actually speaking. Like it's this weird thing. You have many fans, Outlouders, from the Out Loud podcast and presumably from the other podcasts as well. What is the nicest thing that a fan has ever done for you?
There are so, so many. The amount of Outlouders who sent personalized baby gifts when I was having Luna. I have this incredible like playmat that is like literally someone has sewn it with the name Luna on it. Like it is just ridiculous. But the support that community has given me in terms of my career and the things that I've tried to do. In fact, during this process, I interviewed a lot of people about mental illness, stays in psychiatric units, public, private, you know, a lot of different things. And the generosity of someone who has been through something traumatic and, you know, it's not helping them necessarily to sit down with me and chat about their experience. But that both of my books could not have been written without the input of incredibly generous people who are part of those communities, being willing to just help me make stuff. Like it's very much a group. And I think you don't have to be a podcaster to have that. I think if you want to write good stuff, then you've got to start talking about it. Like I have a thing, someone in the book is a carpenter. Like I have a cousin who does that. He was harassed for 12 months by me. Harassed. I was like, what is sheathing? What would you sheathe?
It's
would
very you, like, good. Just... I did read those bits going, that's really real. She like knows a lot about carpentry.
It's like you've got to be willing to really annoy people. But to me, that's the real generosity. And then the fact that they would go out and buy the book, like books aren't cheap and books are not they're such a time investment, which so many women are so time poor. So to sit down and read your words is one of the most generous things someone can do for you.
They're all very gorgeous and lovely fan stories. I am going to ask, you've said the nicest thing fans have done. What's the weirdest?
The weirdest. Oh my God, good question. Look, the weirdest, and this is a very specific to this moment experience, but the weirdest for me at the moment are people who message me and demand my opinion on a particular political moment. To me, I just go, why would you care? Or why would I be the, you know, is my statement going to fix the conflict in the Middle East? Like that to me is a really strange thing to ask of people. I reckon it's probably that. But overwhelmingly, and I've heard this said about podcasts, when you're in someone's ears, there's a real intimacy because it's selective, it's intentional, and it's not background. It's very, very different to radio. So there is, people feel like they're your friends because they are your friends. They really are. Like, there's a two-way relationship. And because of that, there's like, I've just found it to be really productive and really lovely. Like, I'll often be walking down the street, or, you know, I was sitting there the other day breastfeeding, like, in public, and this woman, like, popped up and was like, hi. And I was like, oh, an out loud is seeing my nipple. Like, this is not ideal. But that stuff happens a lot. And it's because they feel like they're your friends, because they are. Mm. So I love that about podcasting.
It's nice. Jesse, we have a lot of listeners to this show that are writers. What is either the best or the worst writing advice you've ever received?
Best, I often say, is Jane Harper, who said to me, life's too short, write the book you want to write. And it sounds really basic, but I think a lot of us are writing the book we feel we can write at the moment with our skill set in the time. Like, screw it, write the book you want to write, be super, super ambitious about it. And I think of stories like, I think it's Meg Mason who wrote a book and then like threw it out. And then her next book was, can't remember the name of it, but brilliant.
Sorrow and Bliss.
Mm. And that was a book she wanted to write. And she wrote it really quickly and really seamlessly. Mm. And the other one never got published. And I'm always like, what I would do to read that book, because she just threw it out. So I find that really helpful. In terms of the worst writing advice, you know what? Anyone who tries to tell you there's one way to do it, anyone who says you have to sit down and write every day for 2 hours, who does that work for? Mm. All it does is make us feel guilty. I'm certainly not doing that. I think that would be it. Just write when you can, do your best. The trick of writing is to keep writing even though you hate everything that's on the page. Completely normal.
Very good advice. Final question, Jesse Stevens, can you recommend a debut book by an author from any time, any place, anywhere?
So, I mean, the best debut books, and I love Australian fiction. I just love it. Obviously, Boy Swallows Universe, but everyone's read that. But I would say Love and Virtue, I just think, is one of the best debut.
Cracker. Yeah.
So good. And it's so good because it's, again, it's brave. Like, it's, there's a real braveness to debut books because people just kind of give it everything. Mm. And I love that. There's also a book in the US. Did you ever read My Dark Vanessa?
No.
Mm, that's an American, I'm sure it was debut. And I remember reading it when I was writing my first book, and I always read the acknowledgements. And she mentioned that it took her 8 years to write. And I was like, this is why my book is crap, because I haven't spent 8 years on it. But that's an outstanding book. I love people just bursting onto the scenes, like such a fun age, like, oh, love debut fiction.
Mm, debut really kind of makes your mark. It feels almost PhD-like in that reveal of self. Like, there's a lot in it that sort of.
So true. It's like putting your cards on the table and going, this is who I am. And in a lot of ways, I think the second one's harder, because it's just like, do you have one book in you, or are you a career author? Because they're very different things.
Mm. That is a lovely note to end on. Jesse Stevens, thank you for being on the First Time Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I loved it.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.